group meeting. I'm very glad to see so many of you are on the way here. Next meeting will probably be about some Ajax development framework. I hope to see you there too. After the meeting, we plan to go to a restaurant kind of thing to get some food and some drinks. Please join us. We haven't quite decided the location yet because we're quite new in this area. So if you have any proposals, please talk to me. I'm going to send a list of lists for you to put your name on so we can keep track of who actually showed up and how many you were. We like to make statistics for that, so please do that. That's for the practical parts. Today we have been happy to get Bruce Perens, the fairly well-known open source evangelist, to visit us because he's in here in Norway, first and foremost for the University College in Agders, where he's, I don't know what it's called in English, Professor Su?
It's a paid vacation.
Yeah, and also because the Minister of Modernization is announcing the Center for Free Software tomorrow, and he's going to join us there.
In Norway?
In Norway, yes. Happening in Drammen tomorrow at 12. Okay. Everyone is invited.
Where can I find more info about it?
www.nuud.no.
Oh,
I'd better buy a dinner. He's having a bad day.
So, Mr. Perens is the initiator of the open source initiative and has been developing quite a few free software projects through the years. I think I'll just stop there and leave the floor to Bruce.
Yeah, so you're getting an open source center tomorrow here in Norway, which begs the question, who asked for it? And actually, this was sort of a surprise to everyone. And Michael and I heard about this because I guess we were both invited to speak, and we were invited to speak before we knew a thing about the leadership of the center. So we sort of said, ooh, we'd better meet these guys. And we actually got one of them to like come back to Oslo from his boat during this vacation and tell us how the center was running. And I'm happy to announce that it's not owned by Microsoft or SCO, and that they actually are doing the right thing. And yeah, so we definitely went out and checked. So yesterday I spoke in Copenhagen, and they gave me 3 hours, and I used all three. Tonight we only have one, fortunately. I had to give them a bathroom break. That's how bad it was yesterday. So what I'm doing today is called Innovation Goes Public. Well, that makes no sense, does it? Innovation goes public? Innovation isn't a company. How can innovation go public? So I did this talk a month ago with Richard Stallman on the stage too. Richard and I were both presenting in Italy. We got to meet the president of the Chamber of Deputies and a bunch of important politicians. So it was really fun. And Richard has very strong opinions about free software. That's probably the best way to explain this. So people, reporters, go to interview Richard, and they open up their laptops, and their laptops all play this Microsoft theme song when they start. Richard says, oh, you've got Microsoft. Would you like me to defenestrate that laptop? Okay, which means, it makes perfect sense in Italian, too. Which means he would remove Windows from the laptop, and no one took up the offer, but I made a point of presenting next to Richard on my Debian system. So, when a company first goes on the stock market, that is called going public. And going public is one of these ways that a lot of people get rich and a lot of people lose a lot of money. Why do companies go public? Well, I will talk about that, and I will talk about the parallels to free software. But this talk isn't about open source companies going public. It's not about Red Hat. We had a video a while ago called Revolution OS that was about VA Linux systems going public. This isn't about that. And open source doesn't really mean those companies. It doesn't mean Red Hat or Source Labs or Sugar CRM. Open source is something else. It's the open source teams. The people who sell it like Red Hat are middlemen. So we're going to talk about a way of innovating in a public setting. But who am I anyway? Best known as the creator of the open source definition, which is the manifesto of open source and the rules for its licensing. Of course, Richard Stallman created free software first. What's the difference, okay? When I talk about open source, I am talking about the same thing that Richard Stallman talks about when he talks about free software. But I'm talking about it in a language that business people can understand. Yes?
What's the difference between Eric S. Rubin's definition? He seems a bit eccentric.
So what's the difference between Eric Rubin and, well, Eric? No one hears very much about Eric anymore, do they?
Oh, an inspire.
Yeah, so.
He did read that because of RPM.
So, Eric at one time thought it was important to deprecate Richard Stallman. He thought that Richard Stallman was an embarrassment and that we should sort of rub Richard out of the picture. Now you'll notice that Richard is very much in the picture and Eric is not much in the picture anymore. And that's really all I should say about Eric, because I shouldn't be too nasty to him. But I founded the Open Source Initiative with Eric, and that was probably a mistake. So I have also founded the Linux Standard Base, which is now the Free Standards Group, Software in Public Interest, which is Debian's corporation, a couple of other things. I was Hewlett Packard's senior global strategist for Linux and open source. Unfortunately, they had this merger, and you know, there could have been a Compaq guy there or an HP guy there, and Compaq was selling more hardware for Linux at the time, because HP didn't have the right hardware for it. So the Compaq guy won. So I think you guys probably all know what open source is. Are there any beginners in open source here?
What?
Yeah. Okay. Are you guys all knowledgeable of open source, or should I explain what open source is? I don't think there are any newbies here.
Yeah, I think so.
What's special about open source? Okay, and this is important for all of you guys who are in the user group and already know everything, because you will be called on at one time or another to explain open source to business people. And that's really hard to do without something that business people can understand. What do they understand? They understand making money. So open source seems kind of weird to them because, you know, we're not selling it. Somebody's selling it, but not the open source developers directly in many cases. And what's paying for the development? However, open source is self-sustaining. We have a 25-year and more history, and we're going strong. Open source's main developers are not its vendors. How does that work? Where are the sales? Where are the profits? And open source is extremely customer-centric in its emphasis rather than vendor-centric. So why do companies go on the stock market? Well, they do it to distribute cost and risk with the motivation of sharing in the rewards. So when you go on the stock market, you sell stock in your company, which is actually part ownership of the company. And that way, you are taking the risk that your company will fail, and you're sharing it with all of your investors. And your investors also share the chance that the company will succeed, and that they'll make a whole lot of money. So if you need to hire a big proprietary software development team, maybe you have to sell somewhere between $5 and $25 million worth of stock to do that. And you do that, and then you go away for 5 years to develop software, and at the end of that process, you start to sell it. And that's when the proprietary software folks can start to make money. They have to develop it to the point where someone would want to buy it, which is unlike open source, and we'll get into that. So what's the cost? They have to pay for all the development first. What's the risk? The stock won't be worth anything if the product isn't desirable or the company is mismanaged. 1 in 5 new companies succeeds. All the rest go out of business. So through the stock market, many investors share the cost and risk of a company. What about the open source and free software world? Well, its developers are directly its customers. So it distributes the cost and risk of development among many developers, because each shares in the development and no one puts in too much. So consider companies that are working in open source today. For example, Google. Google does not sell software. Google has very much software inside the company that is not open source. However, the majority of their infrastructure is open source. It's running on Linux and some of the interpretive languages that are open source, and etc. Amazon.com, again, runs on Linux, Apache, PHP, etc. So those companies are using open source very intensively in their infrastructure. Merrill Lynch, the investment broker, using Linux, using open source Java programs, Spring, Struts, Hibernate, etc. To operate their websites. So those companies, in some cases, are directly participating in the development of that software, and they're also the users. And that is a very interesting thing, because those companies don't sell the software, and they never have to sell that software to make money. So how can they give away software and still make a profit? And how can they give away software without giving away their critical innovations? Well, first of all, selling open source isn't a good way to make a profit. Sorry, Red Hat. Sorry, Nobel. Because someone else is giving it away. And most companies don't sell software to make a profit. So Amazon sells books, they sell wine, you know, people sell computers like IBM and Hewlett Packard, services, etc. They still need software to do a whole bunch of jobs. And those jobs can be done with open source, or they can be done with software that they made themselves, or software that they bought from Microsoft or another company. But when HP or IBM or Merrill Lynch use software to run their website, that software is not in itself a profit-making item. It's part of the cost of operation. In business terms, that software lives in a cost center rather than a profit center. So how can you give away free software if you're a big company without giving away your innovation? Well, there are two kinds of software in the company. So let's talk about Amazon again, because most people have gone on Amazon's website. They understand about Amazon. Go ahead. One click is a patent, and it's an interesting question, but it doesn't really relate to this talk, and we probably can't fit it in the hour. But you know, feel free to have me come and talk about that another time. So Amazon has a differentiating technology that makes them look better than Bertelsmann and Barnes & Noble and the other booksellers. And that is their recommendation system. And the recommendation system runs on data mining. And what it does is, if you go and buy one of the books from the Bruce Perrin series on Amazon, it used to say, I kid you not, people who bought this book also bought clean underwear, because they didn't have any data. Now they have data, and it says people who bought this book also bought these three other books. okay? And the deal with the recommendation system on Amazon is that it looks at what book you're looking at, and it looks at who bought that book and what other books they bought, and it tells you. And 50% of the time that people see that information, they click buy on another of the books that it recommended. So this is a tremendous profit increaser for Amazon.com. Obviously, Amazon cannot afford to let Bertelsmann and Barnes & Noble have the recommendation systems. They can't make it open source. Okay? It happens that Amazon doesn't own the patent for the recommendation system. Sandant owns that patent and was suing Amazon about it, and I have no idea how that worked out, because they probably settled it behind closed doors. But anyway, the recommendation system is differentiating intellectual property, okay, copyrighted property for Amazon.com. What is the non-differentiating software in Amazon.com? It's Linux, it's Microsoft Word, it's PHP, it's Apache. So Microsoft Word, for example, does not make Amazon look better to the customer than another bookseller. Okay, Linux does not make Amazon look better to the customer than another bookseller. Any reliable operating system could stand in its place and it would look entirely the same to the customer. Notice I'm not saying Windows and reliable in the same sense. So the lesson you learn from this is if you have non-differentiating software, you could give everything you know about that software to your competitor, and it wouldn't make a difference in how customers perceive your company. So Amazon can share with Bertelsmann and Barnes & Noble everything it knows about Linux and PHP, and it won't really hurt Amazon's business to do so. Obviously, it can't let them use the recommendation system. So the lesson here is companies have to keep their business differentiators to survive. Where then does open source fit in? Well, how much of the software in your business is differentiating versus non-differentiating? About 95% of the software in any business is non-differentiating. It's what we call infrastructure, enabling technology, etc. And how can you tell it's non-differentiating? For example, if it comes from the open source community or from Microsoft, it is non-differentiating to your business because everyone can get it. Okay? Differentiating software has to be software that you can hold close and keep other people from getting, because otherwise they would have it and they would have your business differentiator. So what lesson can business leaders take from this? Well, if you have a budget to develop software in your company, take as much money from that budget as possible and move it into developing software that makes your company look better to the customer, the so-called differentiating software. Now, remember, 95% of your software is non-differentiating. So where do you get that? You use open source to distribute the cost and risk of developing that software, so that you can pay as little for it as possible, so that you can get as much quality and versatility as possible, so that you can develop infrastructure that is specific for your needs, because open source is so easily modifiable, etc. So this tells you where open source fits in a user company in a way that makes sense to business people, that says, this is how to make more money, by handling our money this way, by moving more into business differentiators. And it's a good way to sell open source into a company. So who makes the differentiating software? There are really only two ways that you can get it. One way is with your own employees. The second way is with a consulting firm. And in both of those cases, you can tell those guys, don't give this to anyone. And that's the key thing that you need for differentiating software, is to be able to have that control. So what we get from this is that there are two kinds of innovation, not just two kinds of software in a company. There is business differentiating innovation, which has high value to a company because it makes them look better than their competitor. And there is the non-differentiating innovation. It has value too because it improves some internal aspect of your business. It helps make it more efficient, easier to run, etc. But it isn't customer visible. Okay? So using Linux is a non-differentiating innovation because Amazon was able to save a great deal of money. They put this in their annual report that they saved $35 million one year by using Linux. They've gotten bigger since then. But they could tell Barnes & Noble and Bertelsmann that without hurting Amazon's business. So what do you do when you have non-differentiating innovation? Well, there are two things you can do. One thing is patent it, and then you license it to other companies, and if some company is using it and they're not paying you, you sue them, and you're in court for years and years, and this means that lawyers are always employed, but it does not add to the efficiency of your company. Okay? However, there is so much misunderstanding about intellectual property in the world that if you ask most companies, they think that they have to hold all intellectual property close. And they are losing money by doing so. Very often, they are sacrificing efficiencies that they could get through collaboration. They are going to court when they don't need to go to court, etc. Go on.
Is this where patent issues, etc., is it very relevant in Latin Europe?
Well, yeah, see, because the United States has enforceable software patenting, and Japan has enforceable software patenting. And there are some very, very big companies, IBM, Hewlett-Packard, Philips, any telephone company you can think of, etc., that would very much like to have Europe to have enforceable software.
Yeah, but like European companies, like I work for Madriva, and you have like it's like a gray area, something.
Yeah. So, for example, here in Norway, there is a consortium of colleges getting together to put together patenting research results.
Yeah, because we can include CSS activity, but we really can't because we sell worldwide. So we have additional repository.
Yeah. To make this story short, if you guys don't keep working every year on this all across Europe, you will have enforceable software patenting just like the United States.
Yeah.
And believe me, I've spent enough time in Brussels working on this issue. And so the first time they had a patent directive, and it was very ugly. We had ministers outing other ministers' mistresses over this fight. This time we had a proposal for a European patent litigation agreement, which may still pass eventually, which may give us more enforceable software patents. So this is applicable to Europe because your country will be just as screwed up as the United States if you're not.
Yeah, but wasn't the parliament overthrown? Was like 600 to.
Yeah, so the deal is with EPLA. They structured the work on that so that the parliament would not be involved. so that we would not have the kind of vote that killed it the last time. So you have to be very careful about this. And this is probably something you should get a speaker from EFF Europe to talk about. So anyway, you do have patenting on software. There are over 30,000 software patents registered in the European Patent Office. The only problem is they're not enforceable right now, which we want to keep it that way. They, by the way, track the text of United States software patents almost perfectly. But so anyway, patenting and cross-licensing, etc., is a way that we use to share innovation between companies. And cross-licensing for the big companies essentially nullified the effect of patenting. The problem is not everyone is a big company, and the little companies can't join this game. And the small and medium-sized enterprises make up 80% of the economy. So it turns out that this is only fair for the very biggest companies. So there's another way that we can share innovation, which is we can share it between companies as free software. Okay, so for example, Linux. Very many companies today participate in the development of Linux. And they do it pretty much ignoring the issue of patents unless they're Novell and Microsoft and two other distributions which are so small that we can ignore them.
Red Hat is very messy.
Yeah, Red Hat, we'll see what happens. And so anyway, sharing your innovation as open source gets rid of the transaction cost of all of this licensing and lawyers. There's a very low litigation cost unless governments increase software patenting in your country, in which case the litigation cost will be higher. So why does sharing non-differentiating innovation pay off? Well, open source is the best way to do it that we know of. So there have been a bunch of consortia where companies tried to share development before they had open source. So Taligent and Monterey were a consortia to redevelop the Unix system for the 90s. Each of those had a $1 billion investment from IBM, Apple, Hewlett Packard, etc. And they fell on their face and were replaced by Linux. There was the Common Desktop Environment, there was Motif. These things were supposed to give us common environments for using X Windows. These were replaced by the efforts of a Mexican kid with no college degree, Miguel de Casa. It was funny, when we first tried to get Miguel into the United States, the Immigration Department classified him as a farmer. Because he had no degree, and we had to make a point that he was a privileged researcher. So what's the difference? Why did open source succeed where these various billion-dollar consortia failed? Because we put the product first. All of the consortia had paid for say. So any of the companies in the consortium could say what direction the consortium should go in, instead of the software engineers making all the rules. The marketers and the executives made the rules. Well, it happened that the interests of these companies were often entirely opposed to what it took to make a good product. So I'll give you the world's worst example of this. Jim Geddes is one of the founders of the X Window system. And the X Window system was a corporate consortium. You'll notice that now it isn't. It's entirely an open source project. X had paid for say in the consortium. Jim says this is the worst mistake he ever made, and he's a married man. And so because he had paid for say, one day the X consortium met, and the X consortium decided that they would not have canonical user interface toolkits for X. They would not have one user interface toolkit. Instead, they would have a separate one for Sun and Hewlett-Packard and Apollo. Remember Apollo? And IBM. And that way, Sun and Hewlett-Packard and Apollo and IBM, because they'd have different toolkits, would be able to artificially raise the expense of changing brands. Because if you wanted to port your software from one to the other, you'd have to reprogram it for the different toolkit. Now this is what's called artificial differentiation. It's artificial because it does not bring any real value to the customer. In fact, it is customer negative. However, you may think it is in your interest as a company to have that kind of differentiation. Well, was it in their interest? Absolutely not. Because when these guys all decided to have different buttons and sliders, etc., Microsoft was out there saying, you know what? We're not going to make them different. We're going to offer the same buttons and sliders no matter what brand of computer we're on, because we don't make computers, we make the software. So, at the beginning of this exercise, Unix workstations were very popular. And at the end of this exercise, Microsoft was very popular because Microsoft did not screw the customer by having four separate user interface toolkits to do the same thing. Microsoft ate their lunch. Okay, the open source projects also have two different user interface toolkits, but it comes from historical reasons that you also would love to hear me explain, I'm sure, but I'm not going to do it today. So, because open source lets the engineers make the decisions, you tend not to get that kind of bad decision. You get what's technically best for the products. So how do open source and free software teams form? Well, it used to be when something strange happened on the news, you'd hear on the radio, police believe this is the effort of an isolated nut. Okay. In the age of the internet, there are no isolated nuts. Whatever kind of nut you are, you can find 50 nuts just like you on the internet. Okay? And if you can find 50 people who believe the same crazy idea, what have you got? Well, that's more people than you would have in a startup company. And 50 people can do real stuff, even just with their spare time. So imagine these crazy things that 50 nuts could do. Like, my friends and I, we're going to write an encyclopedia in our spare time. Okay, who would have thought that that would work? You know, it's like, everything you know is wrong. Encyclopedia Britannica, I mean, the Queen bought every copy, you know? They went on for 200 years without a threat until the internet came along. And the internet connects all of these people in a way that lets them collaborate so easily. And it gives you friends that you never see, and thus you can get along with them much better. And so, especially if you're a nerd, we communicate better via text than we do face-to-face. You know that, most of us. And so, anyway, the Wikipedia is this great phenomenon because the Wikipedia is open source for old fogies. Look at who's writing Wikipedia articles. A lot of them are retired people who have this tremendous knowledge about what they've been working in. And they're frustrated because they don't use it anymore and they want to give it to the world. And so they get on the Wikipedia and they write article after article about it. And like I can be on an airplane and I hear old people talking to each other about the Wikipedia. I don't even know how to pronounce it. Okay, I say Linux wrong. But You know why, by the way? When he lived in Europe, his name was Linus. Now he lives in the United States, and his name is Linus. So, right, okay, I still can't pronounce it. So, but anyway, so we have this incredible power of collaboration that comes from the internet. So what is the marketing paradigm of open source? You know, people ask, open source is horrible because it has no central planning, it has no marketing department. Well, there's a reason for this. First of all, open source does have a marketing paradigm. Marketing paradigm of open source is a massively parallel drunkard's walk filtered by a Darwinistic process. Say what? Okay. So massively parallel drunkard's walk. Drunkard's walk is a mathematical term, which means that we all go in our own direction. And then Darwinistic process. So when we all go in our own direction, a bunch of people make open source projects, and some of them are really cool, and some of them suck. And then there's the Darwinistic filter, which is they release their open source project to the world, and the ones that don't suck get lots of people on them. And thus, the community gets really big. And the ones that aren't so good, nobody jumps on. And they only waste one person's time. So they're efficient. Okay, compare the way that companies work to this. Companies have marketing people. Marketing people go out and survey the users, and they determine what the company should make in the future. Now, marketing people are not particularly accurate at reading the future. If they were accurate, they wouldn't be marketing people. They would be investing in the stock market, and they would own your company instead of working for you. Okay? Marketers have no crystal ball. And so, if you take marketing and you replace it by doing everything, and then filtering from that everything, only the good stuff, it actually works better. But hey, that's the way that the entire industry of software works, because marketing and central planning really only applies to one company at a time. And we don't live in a kind of environment where the government tells every company what to make. People tried that one. It didn't work very well. And so the software industry, just like the open source community, has no central planning. And ask any company president if he would rather have the government dictate to him what his company would build instead of having the freedom to determine that himself. And they'll say, no, I want anarchy. Okay? So it turns out that the way open source works is in general the same way that most companies in the world work. And this assert, when people assert that we have no central planning, etc., they're just firing us. Okay. So where did Nobel and HP and who do you work for, Mandriva?
Yes.
Okay. Where do they fit in? Well, sometimes not very well.
Well, we have like the most crappy management ever that has to run with.
Well, see, your management is crappy because they can't make money.
No. Yeah, well, we had a very good product. We were like the only company that actually sold box sets and made revenue. And through a Mandrake club, where you didn't get any benefits.
Uh-huh.
But people was very happy because they got another product. And then they had like came in the CEO, and he like.
Yeah, it was like John's calling
so,
down.
So now they have like the new investor and a new whatever, so maybe he...
Yeah, but the whole point is this is not unique to your company. In general, companies that sell open source software get into a conflict of interest with the open source developer community. And Red Hat tries to manage them and balance them as well as it can. And Ubuntu tries, and there's very much emotion within Debian over whether Ubuntu is good or bad for Debian.
Yeah, but Ubuntu doesn't make money. They're just
Well, Mark is so rich that Ubuntu doesn't have to make money, but that's another story.
Exactly.
And, I mean, you know, who else buys a $20 million ticket to space and then starts a Linux company? So, anyway, take Novell. So I make GPL software that happens to be in the Novell Linux distribution. And you may have noticed that I was pretty bummed out over this Microsoft Novell agreement. And I felt that most GPL software programmers would be bummed out because it was essentially exercising a loophole in their license. Now, it turned out that Novell made lots of money from this. And, you know, it's really hard to tell those people you should have turned down $333 million because it was being unfaithful to the open source community. Okay, $333 million is a lot of money, especially if your Linux distribution is not profitable, which was the case. I mean, Novell is still third behind Debian and all the Debian derivatives. So, they took the money. And they tried to justify it with us as well as they could. And then Free Software Foundation came in and drove this wedge between Microsoft and Novell, for which I am very grateful. It is continuing to blow up in Microsoft's face, which is good, but that's not the topic of the talk. But the point here is that Red Hat and Novell and Mandriva and Lindos and who are those other guys? They have, you know, 100 users. Those folks, they're like stockbrokers. You know, stockbrokers don't make the stock, they don't make the products, they help move the money around. And they serve a useful function. They're like retailers when manufacturers are wholesalers. But a lot of people think of Red Hat as the Linux company. And you know, they invest some work into building Linux. I can't say they don't, but they're not the whole thing. And I know there are a lot of people here who invest a lot of work into building that system as well. It used to be that I could find my name just with grep on the Red Hat source code. My name was all over Red Hat because they ripped off so much from Debian. So this is a question that I get from people who aren't like you. And it's a question that you should know how to answer. So there's open source for jobs. Okay, and I went and researched this so that I would have a mathematical and economical answer rather than go to hell, which is what I would rather have told these people. And so I looked at the United States Bureau of Labor Statistics and found out that only 30% of the programmers in the United States are employed by a company that sells software in any way. Okay? This is not saying that 30% of the programs written in the world are for sale. It's actually a number smaller than that.
Okay?
What?
Is it services?
No, most of the programmers in the world are working on internal stuff. Okay, they are working on software that is never meant to be sold, and it is infrastructure for the business for which they work. An additional number of programmers are working for companies that rather than sell software, they sell the service of writing software. But I think that those guys are actually counted in the 30% that sell software. Okay, and their software isn't really for sale either. It's done for one company. So what it turns out is that Microsoft is a very, very small minority in the world of software development. Oracle, second biggest software company in the world, isn't it, is in the minority because most of the programmers in the world are not writing software that will ever be sold. Okay, but when you ask somebody, you know, who makes software? You always hear Microsoft first. And if you're going to make a company, they ask, well, how are you going to be the next Microsoft with open source? So what this tells us is that people, when they think about software in general, even us, have a very vendor-centric view of software. And it is a mistake. Okay, if you don't get away from that, you will make the wrong assumptions about how software is actually made and how it can be paid for. Now, here's another question where, you know, it's really annoying, but you have to answer this one. So people ask, should open source be allowed to displace proprietary software? Well, the first answer is, I don't see a whole bunch of proprietary software programmers looking for work because of open source. I see them looking for work because their jobs have moved to India. Or is it China this year? And so, in fact, you know, Source Labs is in Seattle. We actually hire a lot of people who've been laid off from Microsoft. We have to train them. We don't retrain them, we train them for the first time, actually. So there's a parallel to this development of open source, and it is in the 1900s, there was a very large business taking the ice out of lakes in the winter, right here, and with big saws. And they would load it on insulated freight cars and ship it to Spain and everywhere. And it would be stored in insulated buildings all through the summer. And every day the iceman would cometh and would bring your ice and it would sit there and melt all day. So you couldn't really have anything colder than freezing. And that's what happened until we got mechanical refrigeration. So when mechanical refrigeration became practical, this entire ice industry collapsed and lots of people were out of work. But the railroads who carried the ice, they weren't out of work because the development of mechanical refrigeration meant that we could have colder freezers. And thus, we could have frozen foods that we couldn't have before. So we started moving around fish, which we could not preserve for as long, and other commodities. So open source is that kind of innovation. It is a very disruptive innovation, like the end of the ice industry was disruptive. It puts a certain number of people maybe out of jobs, but it also creates new opportunities. So what new opportunities does open source create? Since it is a more efficient way of making software, it means that your company can make more software, it can make better software, it can make software more economically. And thus, software in general gets better. Just ask Microsoft, what was Microsoft like before Linux was a competitor? Well, remember the blue screen of death, okay? Microsoft is actually much more reliable today than it was back then. But back then, they had lots of money to make a reliable system. They just didn't have any competition, so they didn't care, okay? So that is what Linux and open source have done to them. So what we are seeing is an evolutionary change. And so it's important how we state this in political forums. We, in general, will lose, for example, if we ask for a law that prefers open source over proprietary software in government. And you know what? We don't need it. We only need a level playing field. And we don't have a level playing field. If we had a level playing field, open source would usually win. because the advantages of the licensing are very important to the companies that use it, not just the technical advantages. So it has something that proprietary software really can't offer. But what's in our way today? Well, software patenting is increasingly in the way. And other forms of law, digital rights management, means that we can't play media, etc. And those are the kinds of laws that every one of you, if you were sympathetic to open source, should be helping to reform in your own country, please, so that Bruce won't have to fly here every 2 months.
But we don't care.
Yeah, well, you will care because one day the law will change and you won't have any say. That's the problem if you don't stay in this issue. And it will not be a very good world. So if Europe does not support software patenting, a global initiative to increase software patenting fails. So you guys are really critically important to this issue. So there's a very interesting thing about software patenting. We actually have common cause with the small and medium-sized proprietary software businesses because they can't necessarily afford to license all of Microsoft's patents and all of Alcatel's and Philips, etc. So they will end up paying more to do the same things that big companies can do with, you know, not have those royalties. But most of the small and medium-sized proprietary software companies in Europe don't know this. And they go to government and ask for more patentability of software so that they can keep open source away from their markets. And they don't realize that they're hurting themselves at the same time. And one of the ways that we will continue to keep software patenting out of Europe is teaching them. Yes, sir.
Actually, the European Commission is like trying to like form a superpower against the U.S. to like promote open source now. Uh-huh. Like the ISD, information technologies, whatever. Well, that's trying to formulate like form a superpower against U.S. from like in the IT industry.
Mm-hmm. It's not all working that way. So one of the places where it's not working, for example, is in Europe, common Europe, rather than Norway. Norway is sort of like this wart hanging off of common Europe in many ways because, you're not really part of the common market, but if Europe implements a law, you have to do it too. And so this is, you know, what it turns out is that you got to do these things, but you don't necessarily have as much say about them as everyone else.
Have you heard about the ISD?
Uh-huh. So the one that concerns me this month is IDABC. Do I have that right? Okay, so IDABC is working on the rewrite of the European Interoperability Framework, which was very important for Europe because it put the desire for government to use open standards essentially in European law. So IDABC is out to make version 2 of the European Interoperability Format, and they got Gartner to write a so-called independent report on this, and I'll show you something here. Oh yeah, here we are. So IDABC made a mistake of thinking that Gartner was an independent, unbiased commentator. And they contracted them and did not realize that Gartner works for the vendors as well as for some users. And So Gartner got very heavily influenced by Microsoft in what it gave to IDABC on what the European Interoperability Format 2.0 should be. So you'll notice here that this official report to IDABC criticizes EIF 1.0 for its dogmatic focus on open standards. This is European stuff that's happening right now. And let's look for another word here.
Yeah, but there's like the European Commission has like a very large project, which is named ISD Information, so whatever technology society, which is like a cooperation between universities, businesses,
etc. But all of this stuff is being threatened right now in Europe. Because if people like you and me do not respond to this Gartner report, IDABC will have no choice but to implement what the independent commentator recommended. Okay, this stuff is happening in Europe all the time. So of course I am responding and he is sponsoring that. And I got Red Hat to respond, etc. So, Gartner also in this report, they call for, instead of having open standards, having multiple standards. Okay, and what does multiple standards mean? Well, it really means ODF and Office Open XML. That's what's behind this whole argument right now. But says multiple standards, and it makes no distinction between reading multiple standards and writing them. So what happens if European Interoperability Format 2.0 writes multiple standards? Well, you're going to be guaranteed that some of them you will not be capable of reading at all because they won't be open standards. So it will bring us to the Tower of Babel, which is the exact opposite of what EIF is supposed to do. So the point we need to make to EIF is that reading multiple standards is just fine because you're reading them. But writing multiple standards is a bad idea unless they're open standards that everyone can implement, because you'll get in a situation where some of the parties cannot participate because of intellectual property law, for example, and thus vendor lock-in happens all over again. Well, that's just what Microsoft asked Gartner to give them in this report. Okay, so the point I'm trying to make is that you may think that Europe is all for open standards and that Europe is against software patenting, etc. But Europe is only for open standards and against software patenting by a very thin thread, which is maintained by people like you and me, keeping involved in these situations and commenting about them. And you could, if people do not respond, lose the battle for open standards this year in Europe. I am not kidding. Go on.
Microsoft's view of multiple standards, because it's their view is presented by Gartner, is well as ideological and dogmatic that they say about their other people. From a political analysis, it's easy to see that they have their own viewpoint.
Right.
That.
I mean, Microsoft, yes, but when I talk to the minister tomorrow, for example, I will not tell the minister that Microsoft's view is dogmatic. What I will tell the minister is that open document is 500 pages long. And thus, a programmer can learn Open Document in its entirety in a couple of months. And Office Open XML is 5,000 pages long. And thus, a programmer can never learn Open XML before his productive life as a programmer is over. And so, what does this mean? Microsoft will say it's okay that nobody can learn it because you're not required to implement the whole thing. What does this mean? What it means is that some parties will implement some of it, and some parties will implement other parts, and we will have incompatible dialects, which are each a logical subset of Office Open XML, but which do not interoperate at all. This is not the way to run a standard. However, Microsoft, much as we hate it, has a sincere reason to technically, not the business reason, to make Office Open XML. Office Open XML is capable of rendering perfectly every document generated by a Microsoft application back to the early days of Microsoft. Okay, and if Word 75 handled tabs differently, there is in Office Open XML a handle tabs like Word 75 declaration and an example of how to use it. And this stuff goes on and on. But this is assuming that our governments will convert all of their old documents to a new open format, which is silly. They're not going to convert old anything. All that we can really reasonably ask of them is that they start writing new stuff in an open format, for which open document is perfectly fine. The next thing is, nobody in government wants to hear that to use Open Document, you would have to replace Microsoft Office with Open Office, okay? Because, you know, that means that the standard is meant to promote a product. So Sun, understanding that, made a very nice Open Document plugin for Microsoft Office. So Microsoft Office, you can keep it, and you can write compatible files, and if you want to change to OpenOffice 10 years from now, you can still do so, because you have compatible files. Yes?
Yeah, but OOXML has like a very bad implementation on that. It doesn't support Unicode or any other...
You know, OpenDocument has some problems too. Open Document, I think, currently doesn't have a standard for the spreadsheet formula, so you need to have a separate document for that. But you know what? This stuff we could quibble about all day, but the minister would not understand, you know, that issue. The minister would understand 500 pages versus 5,000. And actually, in my report, I go and explain this whole thing in pictures to make it even more palatable of politicians like him.
What's the status in Massachusetts right now?
Oh, Massachusetts. Boy, I mean, they did their very best to ruin this poor guy's career in Massachusetts that they could have Office Open XML. Massachusetts has capitulated and will allow Office Open XML as an open format. The real war now is in ISO. It looks like ISO will not grant fast track certification to Office Open XML because the United States is not going to vote for it because they came one vote short of what was required for them to do so, and that makes it easier for Norway to say no because they know that that vote's already lost.
Was that the last year?
This is just happening now. Norway votes on the 20th. And 22nd, okay. Hi.
Trolltech's viewpoint on OpenXML is the same as yours, is that being a developer, you are not in the position of writing real OpenXML support. End of story. And you are really able to do the same in Open Document. And we have the K-Office guys telling us so we just reported that. Right. I think we should emphasize on that viewpoint.
You can kill Office Open XML simply as a matter of practicality, okay, and nothing else, which is really good because it's easy for people to understand that. Look, Office Open XML may still win ISO certification and will be used in some governments. We're going to have to live with it, unfortunately, but hopefully we can keep it from spreading too far. We've used up all our time, but so feel free to leave, but I'll take some more questions if anyone wants to stay. More questions, anyone? Oh, okay. You can ask me another time.
Yeah.
Email is really good too.
Yeah, ask him for a customer.
Oh, okay. And you guys will have dinner with me, so if you want. It's got to be hard to find a place that will seat all of us. More questions, anyone? Oh, are you guys all done for the night? Go on.
Back to the main topic of your talking, where you said about why companies are going public with their software and giving it away. I think it's one aspect also, and that is what software people are earning money on, or companies are earning money on, is maintaining the software, making it operational. That's what they're doing business on, not of having a license.
Yeah. So
that's one aspect of your business. I think it's important to remember.
In business terms, what this dissolves down to is software is a cost center, not a profit center.
Yeah.
Okay. So it all boils down to software is used to support your operation. Okay.
Yeah,
that's why you need support, etc.
Yeah. But it's also for companies that the main topic is software, but they can say that yes, the software is as is. Those not paying for it, they will probably not. Probably doesn't afford to pay for maintaining the software either. But those that are needing the software for their business operations, they will pay for it.
Yeah. So I support this software on occasion by email Electric Vents. It's a memory allocation debugger. And I got this email from Deutsche Bank. And Deutsche Bank is having trouble making Electric Vents work with a piece of unsupported legacy proprietary software that they still have to use. That's how bad the problem is, you know? And it's like, you guys are stuck with this thing. The company won't even support it anymore. And it happens to be something that also exists in the open source world. And don't they now wish that they were using the open source version because they could pay somebody to support it, no matter who it was. Okay? So proprietary software, you know, when it comes down to it, it's really like buying a car with a hood lock that only the mechanics can open. And, you know, once in a while you can't get those mechanics, you know, for any amount of money to open that key. And if you were a company like Deutsche Bank, with your whole business depending on that stuff working, this is a real bad thing for your business. And, you know, and Hewlett Packard had that too. Hewlett Packard in 1996 had a meeting with Microsoft. Microsoft said that they would soon have an enterprise quality MT. And HP stopped investing in the workstation, their Unix workstation, because of that. And guess what? Microsoft did not fulfill its promise for another 10 years. And so, you know, HP lost probably about $30 billion with a B dollars on that deal. And at the beginning of that, HP owned the engineering workstation market, and at the end of it, some did. So this happens all the time, and there are lots of great reasons to sell this to companies. Go on.
If I understood you correctly, you think that proprietary software is appropriate for what you call the differentiating software?
No, see, proprietary software like Microsoft sells is not appropriate for differentiating software because everyone can buy it. The only proprietary software that's appropriate for differentiating software is software that stays in one company and is never distributed. That could even be GPL software because you don't have to give anyone the source if they never get the binary. Okay? But, you know, that's silly. It actually is proprietary software in one company. So a point that I'm making here is that it still has value to have a trade secret in some companies. And I wish the world didn't work that way, but I can't make the world not work that way. I've not figured it out.
Maybe we could also work with you know, open source plus trademark plus maybe design.
Well, what you get if you try to go down that path is software patenting. And so it's not helping. Right. And you know, someone wrote me, he was doing some sort of framework where he felt that he was providing for sustainable differentiation in his open source framework. And I don't think this actually works because it's encouraging people to patent that differentiation and then go after the open source project if it develops the same thing, for example. So I spend a lot of time thinking about this, and if you can actually make it work, and you have to sit down and think it all through, I'd be happy to hear about it. More. Questions? Yes, sir.
What I was going to say to you earlier was like, information technology is just slightly like the European project funded by the European Commission.
Mm-hmm.
You know about it?
So I know about a number of them, but I don't know which one you're talking about.
Okay. No, it's like a very, very work packages. It's a very large. It's like a lot of universities, businesses.
Can someone help me here?
It's hard to tell. I was working on like a bachelor project on it, and it was like a lot of different things, like cooperation, like you can say like.
We'll have about, to refer this for later.
About everything in IT projects, like trying to like create like a sort of superpower open source, whatever.
Yeah, I'm not sure this is really happening.
It is.
You'd have to show me.
I'll do that offline.
I know that we are developing various open source projects with EU funding, for example, Michael up there is working on the European Internet Operability Observatory, which is open source. HIA is the leader institution, and essentially all the other institutions, I think, are European rather than Norwegian. Go on.
I thought about the differentiating part, because the argument you hear from proprietary software vendors is that by having the whole ownership of the code, just selling binaries because that's what they're doing, is actually a differentiator. How do you explain that in this?
So it's a differentiator for those companies. It's not a differentiator for the customer. And so what Trolltech sells, and Trolltech uses a dual licensing model, Trolltech's technology is very clearly a differentiator for Trolltech. For the most part, it is not a differentiator for the telephone manufacturers. They can get a number of different telephony frameworks, and you know, I'm rooting for OpenMoCo, which I can guarantee you is not based on Pew. And so Microsoft, you know, a lot of features in Microsoft applications are differentiators for Microsoft against the open source community. It just doesn't work out that way for the users. You know, there aren't any new good buttons that you can add to word processors today. There's only things that you can do to lock in the customer. That's known art. That's important to note, is that differentiation for the vendor is not only not differentiation for the user, but sometimes it is actually against the user's interest.
OpenMoCo project uses LGPL as an argument to lock people out and making binaries only.
Who uses LGPL?
OpenMoCo, and the head of the project says so, using LGPL. And the reason to do that is to differentiate and let businesses making proprietary software.
Yeah, so we have this difference between GNOME and KDE in this regard, in that if you want to make proprietary software, you can make it on GNOME without paying anyone for the right to do so. And you can't make it on KDE without paying Trolltech. I don't care, because I don't make proprietary software. I think both approaches are equally legitimate.
I don't talk about GNOME and KDE.
But it's the same with OpenMoCo.
I'm talking about LGPL.
Yeah. GNOME is LGPL to a great extent as well.
Yeah, but OpenMoCo is everything is free, right, except for advanced.
It's not.
It is.
So the in OpenMoCo, I know about this, believe me. There are two processors. One of the processors runs a GSM core, which is proprietary software, but the free software talks to it through a well-defined interface. This is the we're being thrown out guy. And also there's GPS software that is not open. However, I know where to get free GPS software. It was developed for an AMSAT Oscar 40 satellite. It's interesting. Now, there's a potential for OpenMoCo to have a number of different user interface platforms. There's no reason you couldn't have Qt applications in it, but I think that's probably not where the development direction is currently heading, just because they decided they want to support proprietary software without the proprietary guys paying anything extra. So we get into the argument, if you let proprietary guys have a free ride, is it more free or less free? Okay, and you guys can have 10 meetings to decide that one and tell me when you're done. I think we have to close up today.
Yes.
So thank you very much for having me.